Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
Well, welcome everyone to the third virtual stock slam in a little over 3 months. It is an absolute pleasure to be back again as your host tonight after our last event in April. We've got an excellent lineup of speakers and companies with many of the people pitching for the very first time tonight, which is fantastic. I mean, this is very exciting because we really want to encourage investors to get involved with the slam. Now, before we get going, there's a few things I just want to go through. Firstly, Alan McBride has kindly updated me with the performance figures for the previous stock slams, i.e. the last two. I must admit, I'm a little embarrassed to mention these figures because both of my picks are at the bottom of the table and facing relegation. So that's not so good. However, the total portfolio of 20 holdings is currently up 10.5%, which is not bad, considering recent volatility in the markets. Obviously, as you might expect, there's a wide spread in performance, with Reynolds remaining the standout winner yet again, and it's up an amazing 75% in the last quarter, which is an astonishing performance. So well done, Paul. Halfords still doing well at 41%, but Tech Capital is closing in fast at 32% up, and that was only pitched a month ago, so that's an outstanding performance too. Sadly, my pitch from last month, Micro Focus, is the dog with a fall of 12%. No, still, I've got high hopes for this month. Fingers crossed. Now, for those new to the slam, I'll quickly explain how it all works. Each presenter is given 3 minutes to pitch their ideas, which tend to pass very quickly. And then we allow another 3 minutes for questions from the audience. And Tamsin will shortly explain how that works. After that, I will introduce the next speaker and we'll start the whole process again. And all in all, the slam should be done and dusted in a little over an hour when we can all relax with a glass of wine. Now, one other thing I'd like to mention is that everyone presenting here tonight is doing so in a personal capacity. This means we're not giving share tips or advice, much as maybe sometimes you'd like to receive them. These are simply investing ideas that we're happy to share with everyone else. So to avoid any doubt, it's best to assume that presenters hold the shares they're pitching and they're talking their own book. Still, something you don't have to worry about is missing anything, because PI World are recording the whole slam and a video of the event will be available before the weekend. And in case you hadn't noticed, we are also running a Discord channel right now along with the slam. And if you look in the chat window, there's an invitation. And if anyone wants to join there and join in the conversation during the slam and afterwards, that'd be fantastic. And finally, I'd just like to thank PI World and Stockopedia for their assistance in getting this event up and running. None of this would be possible without them. Okay, well, as you can see, I'm going to talk about Softcat today. This is a leading IT infrastructure and services provider based in the UK. It was founded in 1993 as a simple software reseller, but it pivoted to become an all-round provider in 2006. What this means is that it helps other businesses to make product service decisions that they cannot make themselves. The bulk of the customers are small to medium businesses, with a balance coming from the public sector or some larger enterprise businesses. And the vendor partners who Softcat deal with are exactly who you'd expect: Apple, Microsoft, Cisco, Dell, all the big names. Now, as we can see over here, the Softcat listed in 2015. And if we can scroll down to the Stocko page, clearly shows strong and consistent growth, even in 2020. So there we can see, I mean, it's all green, absolutely some fantastic figures. 2020, even 10% growth there. So essentially earnings are up over 3 times in 6 years on a simple doubling of turnover. And this tells you there's a story here of margin improvement with a step change coming in 2017, 2018. And this, of course, feeds directly into the return on capital figures. And you've got a stunning return on capital going from 40% to 60%. And you can see that halfway down the screen. Although, to be fair, this high return on capital is based on rapid capital turnover rather than high defendable margins, which leads obviously onto the question, does Softcat have a moat? Now, I happen to believe it does, but not a traditional one. Its moat is the strong corporate culture that runs from top to bottom. And this is one which focuses on employee and customer satisfaction above all else. And this creates strong, enduring customer relationships based on trust and delivery. And of course, with IT being mission critical for businesses, trust is more important than cost, within reason. And this makes sense, of course, because small and medium businesses need expert help that they don't have in-house. And what we know is that customers are clearly happy, because they tend to stay for many years with Softcat, and they have a single account manager looking after them. And the employees are very happy, if you look at the comments on Glassdoor, once they got through the first couple of years learning the ropes. And of course, shareholders are happy because their share count is unchanged and profits are rising. And this is in some part because employees become significantly more profitable as they gain experience and handle larger clients. So what about recent trading updates? In the half year results published in March, EPS was up a mighty 39% on sales growth of 10%. And that's not, there's no COVID effect there either, because the half year ends in January the 31st. It's a great result. More importantly, half two has begun well, and the full year results will be significantly ahead of previous expectations. And this follows previous excellent updates in January, and in previous years to 2020, there's always a pattern with Softcatalyst beating expectations the years it progresses. The sticking point is price. The valuation is high at a PE of 38, and there has been rating expansion over the last 5 years. However, earnings have risen relentlessly over this time, and more important, the business has a habit of beating expectations. So given that well-run businesses tend to stay well-run, I'm happy to hold Softcat in my portfolio, and I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you, Damien. The questions are now coming in thick and fast. So the first question, do you expect the global silicon shortage to impact their ability to deliver growth in their core IT offerings?
No, not really. I mean, they're not a hardware provider. They will help customers source hardware, and they will kind of bring them together with the vendors, but they're not really holding any stock and they're not supplying hardware. So I think they're much more of a software infrastructure services kind of business, which essentially allows the customer to build the right package for them and helps them get it delivered to their door.
Thank you. And why are the earnings flat for next year?
Let me just have a quick look at the Stockopedia report. The main thing, I think, with Softcat is that they tend to underplay things. And so early in the year, they don't kind of bang on about how they're going to beat expectations, how well the business is doing. They tend to let the numbers speak for themselves. So as you go through the first quarter, second quarter, the third quarter, that is when they start saying, well, actually, we're beating what we thought we'd be doing. We're getting better and better. And so I think analysts tend to underplay their numbers just because there's this kind of lagging effect with the business and with the way management talk about the numbers they're going to produce.
And why would you invest in Softcat rather than Computer Centre, which has a higher stock rank?
Well, I invest in both, to be honest. They are very similar space, and I've invested in them both the same reasons, which is that there is this continuing driving force in the IT sector where companies need to upskill and up-resource. But Computer Centre is working at the bigger end of the market, so bigger customers. It's working with unified communications. It's not a UK-centric business either. It's got arms in Europe and in America. So it's a different sort of beast. Softcat is, I say, much more focused. It's UK-focused. It deals with smaller companies, and it's very good at what it does. So I'm happy to hold both of them.
The next question is, do you have a target price?
No, I don't. I don't tend to think like that, to be honest. I'm more interested in buying when I think that the forecasts are perhaps lagging what the company is doing. And then I just let the share price do what it wants to do.
And what do you think will trigger the growth?
Well, I don't know about trigger the growth. I mean, it's had fantastic growth over the last 5 years. And I mean, even before it listed, the turnover went up 10 times in 10 years, up to 2015 when it listed. So this is not a short-term growth story. I think growth continues because A, it's finding new customers, which is obviously how you grow, but B, also sells more to the existing customers. And because companies have a single account manager throughout their time at Softcat, unless, of course, somebody leaves, they build a relationship, and the companies tend to buy more as time goes on from their account manager. So I think that it's generating in growth both internally in that sense and obviously finding new small and medium businesses to sell to.
Tremendous, Damien. Thank you. So let's see what the poll has to say. So 15% buy, 5% sell, and 80% watch. Back to you, Damien.
Awesome numbers. Thank you. Well, 80% watch. Well, yes, watch it go up is what I hope. So next up, we have Jamie Streeter, who's going to talk about PayPoint.
Hi there, Damien. Okay, yeah, PayPoint, as you say, it's a £400 million small cap company. You're probably familiar with it, but it offers a network of 27,000 outlets via partners serving local communities in the UK, which makes it bigger than all the banks and supermarkets and post offices combined. Through that network, it offers retail services to convenience stores, and it has over 17,000 of its PayPoint One terminals in convenience retailers, and also offers EPOS services to around 9,000 of those. It also offers multi-pay solutions for people to be able to pay bills, top up mobiles, send e-money abroad, and has 3,700 plus ATMs in that network as well. And also more recently, they've started to offer parcel pickup and drop off in over 10,000 of those locations. So that's the business. In terms of the future prospects, that network in convenience retail and also the parcels side of things they've just got into taps into the growth that we've seen recently in shopping locally, and that's expected to continue. And also the online purchases, everyone has done lots more of that, and that, again, that's a long-term trend. So the pickup and collection business there will tap into the growth of that. And some of their business should also see a modest pickup from reopening as well, although obviously they were fairly robust during the COVID pandemic. Some of their outlets were closed for a period of time. Where else can get some growth from? They've recently sold their Romanian business for £48 million and then reinvested that and some more money, it's about 70 to 80 million, into three acquisitions recently, which have broadened their customer base, increased the multi-pay services that they can offer to their customers, and also the sectors that they serve. And the biggest one of those was basically HandyPay, which offers, you know, the handheld terminals you get handed in a restaurant. So again, there's a sort of reopening benefit there for retail and hospitality customers they're serving. Balance sheet is fine, no issues with debt or pension fund issues, but there could be about 30 million of debt at the year end when they report at the end of this month, given the acquisitions that they've made. Cash flow is very strong, and that supports the ongoing dividends and investment in the business. In terms of the investment case, it's a very capital-light model, just not many assets on the balance sheet, just those terminals and the investment in the software. That gives very high return on capital employed and operating margins. So it has a Stockopedia quality rank of 98. Value, it's only on about 11 times, which is the bottom end of its historic range. And the yield is about 6%, and that's paid quarterly. So you've got a Stockopedia value rank of 85 and a stock rank of about 85 as well. It's had terrible momentum, seen poor estimate revisions, but that's come to an end by the looks of things. And I think with what we've been doing to the business, certainly there are forecasts for growth going forward from here. So I think the scope for it to re-rate back to a more average rating of about 14 to 15 times, which would give you a target of 700 to 750p, something like that, which is where it was just last summer.
Great. Thank you very much, Jamie. And we've got loads of questions. As a green-black play, I agree with you. However, how do you view the US sell-off in tech and how this could impact PayPoint going forwards in the next 1 to 3 year horizon?
I mean, to be honest, I don't think the US sort of tech sell-off is going to affect PayPal, because it's involved in technology insofar as it provides terminals and software to, you know, local convenience stores and all that sort of thing. But, you know, people are still going to go and pay their bills, top up their mobiles, and those retailers are still going to need to use their electronic point of sale terminals and all that sort of stuff. So I don't really see that being an issue for this one.
And the revenue and profits being flat for 5 years, what will trigger any growth?
Well, I think the reason for that is really that the mobile top-up part of it has been the big drag there. And where they've now reinvested this 70 to 80 million into these other businesses, broadened out the customer base and tapping into other markets as well. So you've got growth coming from that side of things. You've also got the increased usage of their PayPoint One terminals that they were investing in the last few years. And they've got a big push on at the moment to get more of their members signed up for the EPOS terminals. And they've got about three levels to that. So there's a basic, medium, and a higher sort of ranking part of it. So they should probably get some growth from that, and also the general growth in people shopping more locally. And then also the parcels business that, as I mentioned, taps into the online buying and selling and people having to return parcels and all that sort of stuff, which again got affected a bit by the lockdown because people were at home, so they didn't need to go and drop a parcel off and pick it up from somewhere else. But again, that sort of business should come back, and they've certainly seen growth in that. So I think it's those aspects that should help them to grow. And with that acquisition, that's probably taken the sort of non-growth bit down to about 40% on a pro forma basis, whereas these other bits should be about 60% of the business and they should be growing. So I think, yeah, it's had a pretty ropey track record in the last few years, and say it's definitely a contrarian value idea, and the momentum is pretty poor, and you know, accept that. But I just think looking at where the rating is, where the forecasts are going, we expect to see some growth coming through the next couple of years from those things I've talked about. You know, I think it's just got too cheap for the quality that it offers, and potentially the growth. Now, of course, that could be a triumph of hope over experience, but you know, I think if they can deliver some growth, then you know, I think it would probably deserve a re-rating once people wake up to that. Because I suspect most people's impression of it, oh, it's going nowhere. You've got the top up sort of declining, and yeah. But you know, I think that the story has changed somewhat.
Tremendous, Jamie. And we're out of time, but we've now launched the poll. So let us know whether you'd buy, sell, or watch. And the results of that are 25% buy, 19% sell, and 56% watch. So thank you very much indeed for that. And Damien, back to you.
Oh, no, thanks, Jamie. I must admit, I've occasionally looked at PayPoint as a high yield play in the past. And to be fair, the company has really delivered on this front with its blizzard of special dividends in the last few years. I worked out that it paid £5.55 of dividends over the last decade, which is, they've almost got the shares for free at this point, which is pretty remarkable. So next up, we have Darcy Andrews with CVS. Welcome, Darcy.
Thank you, Damon. CVS Group, ticker CVS, listed on the AIM 100, and with a market capitalization of $1.5 billion. So CVS Group is a veterinary services group with four divisions. By far the largest and most important is the veterinary practices, of which they've got 500. Most of these are in the UK, but they do have some in the Netherlands, and they have seven in the Republic of Ireland. They account for 86% of revenue. The other three divisions are Pet Crematoria, of which they've got seven. They have some diagnostic laboratories, of which they've got three, and they've got an online presence with their website, Animed Direct. Now, of course, the start to all this is pets. Lots and lots of pets in the UK. I take my figures from the British Pet Food Wholesalers Association, who tell us there's 12 million cats, 12 million dogs. But the important figure in my eye is the number of people who've taken on a pet during lockdown. They claim 3.2 million households have taken on an additional pet during lockdown. So that's 3.2 million households that are going to need vet services for the next 10 or 15 years. So $64,000 question in my mind is CVS Group the route to this market? I believe it is, but I'm going to go first with the negative points, of which there's three. First of all, it's expensive. The PE is, forward PE at the moment is 31, which is high. Some of the growth perhaps already costed it. Secondly, they had a rather rough spell in 2018, 2019, issued more shares, diluted the existing shareholders on the acquisition trail, aggressively acquiring new practices, and they had a nasty profits warning in 2019. Third negative point is the availability of vets. There's a shortage in the UK, and CVS Group themselves runs at 7% short of their ideal headcount. So on to the bullet points, of which I have four. Firstly, they have a good subscription model. Obviously, that's very favourable for regular cash flow. They have the Healthy Pets Club, so people loving to pay for things monthly can join the Healthy Pets Club. 430,000 people already have. A typical monthly cost for a dog is, I think, £15 a month. Second point is possible growth into Europe in the future. And the third point is I'm a trader at heart. I love graphs. They have a wonderful graph. It's gone steadily up over the last year without too many lumps and bumps. And the share price has run above the 50-day moving average since, I think, June of last year. So CVS Group, one for people to have a look at. Tamsin, I'm sure you've got some questions for.
Darcy, thanks very much indeed. So what's your target price on this?
I haven't got one. I don't sort of run with a target price. I buy something that I think is has got lots of positives, and I run with it and review it almost all the time.
So if you're trading it, is there a trading range you look at?
Well, when I buy something, my criteria is it likely to increase between 10 and 15% in the next 2 months?
Thank you. And do you have any concerns on the low return on capital employed of 7% and operating margin less than 6%?
Yes. I mean, obviously, neither of those things are an advantage. You know, I particularly like return on capital employed. That's a very weak point with this company. But as I say, I tend to like the technicals. The technicals are very good. If you compare them to Pets at Home, for example, which is in a similar marketplace, they look much better. I do hold Pets at Home as well. They've got lots of good points too.
And are you not worried about constant dilution?
No. It's a concern. Dilution in general terms is obviously a concern. I think they're steadier now. They've got a much more considered acquisitions program. They're acquiring more slowly than they were, less sort of ambitiously. And I think it's far less likely than it's been in the past. I think the new management that came in 2019, new CEO, new CFO, are much more considered, and that is less of a fear.
Thank you. And the market's only expecting a 3.5% revenue growth next year and a 6.5% EPS growth. Are you expecting more?
No. As I say, I review as the thing goes along because I tend to be relatively short term. I do see a longer term opportunity here, which is one of the reasons I bought it for, because there's possibilities of expansion into Europe. They've got the foothold with the practice in the Netherlands. They've intimated they might look at France and Germany. So I think there's a very long runway there, which could, in the long term, change things quite considerably.
And very briefly, what went wrong in 2019?
As far as I can see it, they were overambitious with acquisitions and they were paying too much for the goodwill of the businesses. For goodwill, I read, you know, the customer base, which fades away very quickly. So I think they were trying to move too quickly with the acquisitions, and that's needed to be reined back.
Tremendous. And now we'll get the results of the poll. So 22% would buy and 24% would sell and 54% would watch. So we've got quite a lot of people watching quite a lot tonight. Thank you very much indeed. And Damien, back to you.
Cool. Thank you, Tamsin. Thank you, Darcy. I'm not surprised that veterinary practices and anything else with animals have gone bananas during the pandemic. I mean, it's almost impossible to buy a puppy for less than $2,000. And if you're paying that sort of money, I doubt you'll skimp on the vet's bills. So, yeah, definitely an attractive business model, unless everyone gives their pets back, obviously, when they go back to work. Anyway, I'd like to welcome back Lillian back to the slam. Thank you for coming back, Lillian. And she's going to be presenting Ergomed. Over to you.
Hello. The company I've picked today is Ergomed. It's got a ticker symbol of ERGO. It's listed on the AIM market of the London Stock Exchange. Ergomed provides specialist services to the pharmaceutical industry. It helps in the development of new drugs, and it's got a market cap of 582 million, an average daily trading volume of 100,000. It's got two divisions, a clinical trials division, so it functions as a clinical research organisation, which mainly focuses on doing trials for rare diseases and oncology, and it's got trials in over 50 countries, and a second division of pharmacovigilance, which is about monitoring and dealing with adverse events, and it's got studies in over 100 countries. It operates around the globe, in North America, Europe, MENA, which is Middle East and Africa and Asia Pacific. It's got about 1,100 employees, about 300 customers, and about 2.8 clients per employee. It reported annual revenues of 86 million, annual operating profit of 13.5 million, and Stockopedia classified it as a high flyer and a quality rank of 85. About other figures, although I don't understand so much about other figures, but it does allude to a strong balance sheet. It appears to have no debt. It did not take financial assistance during the pandemic, and its revenues went up 26% in 2020 from 2019. Risk factors could be legislation or cancellation or delay of trials. What do I like about this particular share? I actually think it's got an inherent strength and resilience about it. Since formation in 1997 and IPO in 2014, it's built up 1,100 employees, over 300 clients, and it's got a strong client base. It's got clients from the top 10 pharmaceuticals and generic organisations to small and mid-sized drug development companies, and they've performed over 1,400 trials. It's very acquisitive. Since IPOing in 2014, it's conducted at least 7 acquisitions. Latest 2 are in the United States, one where it expanded its range into oncology clinical trials, and another one where it expanded its remit in pharmacovigilance. It really recently expanded into Japan with opening an office in pharmacovigilance. Secondly, it's in growth areas. CROs are expected to grow 6% per annum for the next 5 years, but rare disease, 9% per annum, oncology, 11%, pharmacovigilance, 16%. And last but not least, proof of the pudding is its track record of performing. In 5 years, Ergomed has gone up over 780%, NASDAQ 170%, 2 years, Ergomed 400%, NASDAQ 60%, 6 months, Ergomed has gone up over 40%, NASDAQ has gone up over 10%. So to conclude, I'm not a super forecaster, but I believe it is worthy of consideration by my fellow investors. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lillian. Somebody says everything looks good except for the very low return on capital employed. Any comment on that?
Interesting question. I'm wondering, because they're a clinical research organisation, and you know they do clinical trials over many years. They've got lots of employees that have to do a lot of work. It's not maybe like just developing a product and then just getting rid of it, but they have to invest a lot in terms of time and energy and money per employee to sort of get an output. So that might be some reason for that.
Thank you. And what happened in 2017 and 18, consecutive years of negative operating margin?
Well, I think they were actually reorganising the business at that particular time. So at that time, they had a different business model where they did co-development, and they decided to transition from that. Well, that was one part of their business, but they decided to to wipe away from that completely to becoming a full service CRO. So it was the sort of transitioning from one business model to another business model.
Thank you. And what's caused the recent share price movements?
I think because it's quite an acquisitive company. Well, first of all, I think health in general is on everybody's radar, and clinical trials are very much on everybody's radar. Everybody from age 5 to 100 knows about clinical trials now, with COVID clinical trials. So, you know, that's given it a big boost as such. But also, I think it has it's conducted a couple of acquisitions in America. So one acquisition it acquired MedSource in 2020, which performs clinical trials in oncology, and it came ready with staff and clients. So it was a great acquisition for the company. It also acquired a company called Ashfield in late 2020, which was in pharmacovigilance, and it came with already lots of clients and staff as well. And the USA is probably the premier market in the world for kind of clinical trials, that 50% of it is. So, you know, you really want a good foothold in the United States if you are to do clinical trials. So the market is welcoming its sort of expansion into USA, which is the leading market in clinical trials.
Thank you. And do you currently hold it?
I do currently hold it. I've held it since October, I think, 2020. How much it's gone up, but I am happy, very, very happy with its progress, and I will continue to hold it long term.
That's great. We're out of time. So, in terms of what the audience think, 23% would buy, 28% would sell, and another 49%, being the largest proportion, would watch it. Lillian, thanks very much indeed, and Damien, back to you.
I actually saw Ergomed present a share stock 5 years ago and was pretty impressed by their prospects. However, not impressed enough to buy, unfortunately, which makes me a bit queasy given the share price is up 10 times since then. And that's with the share count almost doubling. A rather avoidable mistake due to my hesitation. So next up, we have Francis Evans, who's going to talk about Innovaderma. Welcome, Francis.
Thanks, Damien. Good evening, everyone. Yes, my chosen company in Innovaderma, ticker IDP, is listed on the main market with a market cap, as you can see, a bit over 10 million. And the stock rank isn't looking good. It's quite illiquid and around its year's low. So it's a specialist recovery situation. And I fully accept that this won't be right for everyone. So if you all vote sell in the poll at the end, I won't be at all offended. Just for a bit of context, Paul has written a number of times in the small cap value report about the price rises that have occurred in many of our companies over the last year, often doubling from their lows. And the result is that I'm finding some of my target companies quite expensive, with, as it were, the good news priced in. I'm being expected to pay now for several years of growth. So I'm looking for contrarian opportunities that the market has marked down. This is not something where you'd put in 20 or even 10% of your portfolio, but as a starter position, it seems to me it has good risk reward. Innovaderma's business is really simple to understand. It makes personal care and skincare products, and it sells them through retailers such as Boots and Superdrug and directly online, about 50-50. It competes against much larger firms like Procter & Gamble and L'Oreal and Unilever. And in that respect, it's very similar to War Paint London, although that's a discount brand selling cosmetics, but essentially the same business model. So you've got a company with a bit over 10 million of sales selling into multi-billion pound markets around the world. It could double sales, it could multiply sales tenfold, its competitors would barely notice. It's got strong brands and it sells right across the English-speaking world from Australia, South Africa, the UK and North America. So it's that potential to expand sales that I find attractive. So what's gone wrong? You can all see the share price chart. It was a confused product strategy, poor marketing, fragmented brands and subscale activities. In short, poor management. That has completely changed. There's a new management team in place. If it'd be possible, please, to have a look under the accounts tab. You've got the major shareholders, which is such a useful feature of the stock report. And you'll see there, Mark Ward is the largest shareholder at just under 14%. Mark, in fact, lent the company £500,000 as a shareholder loan and has now converted that into equity. And this is the same Mark Ward who also owns 10% of Revolution Bars. So he's a significant shrewd investor, I would say. So in conclusion, the company has the potential for significant sales growth, and yet it's on a lower sales multiple than its peers. And so I'm looking for that to change over the next few years.
Thank you. That's tremendous. And are you worried that the company is simply going to run out of cash?
Well, it's just raised substantial new capital by issuing shares through a placing and open offer. And if you look at that shareholders tab, you also see a number of other individual investors who've come in, as well as two institutions. So for the time being, the company is completely recapitalized. And no, I'm not worried about that.
Thank you. And you refer to strong brands. What are the brands? Are there any names we'd recognize or any that you've tried and you like?
So they tend to be in things like hair care, which is rather superfluous in my case. That brand is called Roots. Charles and Lee is a brand that is strong in Australia, which they've just launched here. And Skinny Tan is the best known brand. So if you put Skinny Tan into a search engine and have a look, it's a new website that they've just revamped. And I think they look really attractive products compared to the competition. So I'd encourage people to do that.
Thank you. And they rejected a bid from Crichton's. Was that a mistake?
Great question. It seems I was encouraged by the fact that the shareholders felt that Crichton's, which has got a bigger business, a really well-respected management team, they thought, no, we can make more return with the team we've got and be, you know, we can fully benefit from the turnaround in this company. So I was really interested that the shareholders rejected that bid from Crichton's. I think in their place, I might have accepted it, but that was the confidence they had in the turnaround situation that they've all invested in.
And why hasn't it grown more historically, and why do you think it's going to grow now?
I do think it was down to the quality of the management. So I bought into this company a couple of years ago and sold again, because I just lost confidence in the strategy, which just seemed to have too many subscale brands. And I think the new team are much more focused. What they say makes far more sense to me. And Mr. Ward himself is on the board, as well as being a shareholder. He was the founder and CEO of a company called Hunter McDonald's, which he took public, IT services. So he really understands online marketing and how to use the technology properly in that business. So I see it as much, in a sense, a technology business as a healthcare and beauty products business.
And very quickly, do you have a target price?
Yes, I would be looking for this to double in 18 months or so. Do have a look on FinCap. They're the broker. You can access their research. They have a target price of 90 pence within a year. I would be surprised if it did that well, but I'd be looking for that within 18 months. But then after that, potentially to double again, because that potential of sales increase and then multiple expansion as it becomes more highly rated can be very effective.
Tremendous. Well, let's see what the audience think. 30% would buy, 30% would sell, and 41% would watch. Francis, thanks very much indeed. And we'll go back to Damien.
Cool. Thank you, Francis. I do like the fact that the audience like to watch and see what's going to happen. I'm still not really sure that Innovaderma is an appropriate investment for me, but its Lamo hair products do get surprisingly positive reviews if you look online. This strikes me as somewhat remarkable, given that most hair loss systems are little more than a snake oil. And personally, I'd rather buy a nice hat, but, you know, I guess that's just me. Anyway, next up, I'd like to welcome back Dio Hare, who's going to talk about Just. Off you go, Dee.
Hi, everyone. My name's Dee. There's five things I look for in a share. So that's a simple story, good cash flow, limited downside, the potential to rise 50% in 2 or 3 years, confirmed by a chart pattern. I'm talking about Just Group, which has a market value of 1.1 billion. Quality you can see is low at 35, value exceptionally high at 99, momentum 92, overall stock rank of 91, and it's regarded as a turnaround story, which I agree with. So what do they do? First of all, they work with pension trustees and they de-risk defined benefit pension schemes. Then if individuals have a defined contribution benefit scheme, pension scheme, they give you guaranteed income. And also they work with equity release, where they purchase your home, provide an income. And they, yeah. The point is that all of these are growth markets due to the aging population and the fact that we're all sort of now responsible for our own pensions much more so than before. The problem is that when you sell a pension product, the regulator requires you to have a very high safety margin of spare capital before you write new business. So the history of Just Group is that it's a merger of two failing businesses. And then with increased caution from the regulator, increasing capital requirements having to be set aside, just historically or in the recent history, has not been able to write much new business. So the share price, which was 200p in 2015, fell as low as 40p after the pandemic. There's a new management team, and they're all about creating sustainable capital. So really, I see this business all about trust. We need to trust that the regulators keeping an eye on these in the businesses. They have assets of about 23 billion, which are a mixture of highly rated bonds and UK housing. The housing is at a loan to value of 36% and is hedged to the downside, but we know that UK house prices have risen in value, so that gives them upside. They have a very high solvency ratio. And the new business that they do write is very profitable, to the tune of about 10% profitability. If we look sort of at other valuations, we can see that there's a very steady growth in their net asset value over the last 5 years. And we see that Just is actually, the net asset value is about 200p, Just as a ratio of 0.5. Comparing to the market, Legal & General is 1.2, M&G 1.2, Randall & Quilter at 1x. Back in 2006, Just Group was a share price of 160p, which was equivalent to its net asset value. So looking to the upside, we can see from the stock report that earnings forecasts have increased. And I think with excess capital, they can write a lot more new business, and that will enable them to generate sort of a lot of current profits in a growing market. And the chart looks very, very favorable. There's a very strong triangle bottom formed over 3 years, and there's now a very clearly rising 50-day trend to ride the recovery. Thank you.
Tremendous. Thank you very much. So what do you make of the FCA's consumer duty of care proposals announced on Friday? Is that a potential to hurt already tight margins?
Wow, there's a tough question to start. I don't know the detail of that. I guess ultimately these guys are operating in a business which is about pension provision, and ultimately the cost of all of that falls onto the consumer. The bigger, better businesses will survive in this market. And I have confidence in this management team to deliver whatever the regulator needs. The regulator is my friend in this case, because it's keeping everything in check.
Thank you. It's a very good business. So how do you value? Is it on earnings or is it on something else? And what's your target value and time frame?
I think sort of the safety net is looking at the net asset value. So, you know, regulated assets are measured kind of at 199p a share. If you look at the chart, there's kind of a target price of about 160p where they've consolidated before. That would put them at only 0.8 times net asset value. So that's kind of my target over sort of a, let's say, 18-month, two-year time scale.
Thank you. And what happened last November?
So I guess this is an insurance business, and you know, it has assets and it has liabilities. So those are all kind of quite sensitive markets. And with the you know, pandemic, people were very worried about sort of, you know, solvencies, what's happening, asset prices and long-term liabilities, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's where I say this leap of faith, where one must assume that the regulator is ensuring that they have sufficient capital to enable them to meet their liabilities. And they have a huge safety net. And you can see that when people began to have a bit more confidence, the share price has been a huge rise from 40p to the current just over £1.
Thank you. And are you concerned that the CFO sold 160,000 shares at the end of March?
No. I don't know what reason was given for that sale, but no, not concerned.
Do you know if it was a small part of his holding or whether it was a large part of his holding?
Yeah, in fairness, the management team don't have a huge amount of skin in the game. Sort of, they own sort of a few hundred thousand shares each, so they don't have huge holdings.
And it's a very competitive market. What's their competitive advantage to win business ahead of competitors?
I would put Just kind of as the, you know, market leader, either in terms of their quality or reputation. I think, you know, I'd regard them as second tier, but I think that's reflected in the valuation. I think they do a decent job, and it's in a hugely growing market. So they don't have to be the best in the business to grow, because the market growth itself is so large. And they're at such a discount to their net asset value.
Dee, many thanks indeed. Let's have a look at what the audience think. 43% say buy, 13% sell, and 44% watch. So you've convinced a few there. So thanks very much indeed. And back to you, Damien.
Thanks, Dee. I think if Cockney Rebel was here, he'd rather like the decent share price bold formula of the last year. And also, if you look at the Stockopedia page, the stock rank perked up around the same time. And if you'd purchased when it first went over 90, you'd have doubled your money. I'd be pretty happy with that return. And anyway, talking about stocks ranks, up next we have Ed Croft, who is a man who needs very little introduction, and he's going to talk about Tremor.
Hi, thanks for the introduction. Right, yes, I am today pitching Tremor International. It is a stock I do own. It's a programmatic video advertising platform for brands in the connected TV markets. It trades on AIM with the ticker TRMR, as you can see, a market cap of about 930 million. It's got no net debt. It's got net cash. It's got a pretty high stock rank of 82 and a very high quality rank of 95. But we should be aware this is a very highly speculative stock with a highly speculative risk rating. It's risen 7x from its low in the March crash. Very much a premium momentum share, definitely not for widows and orphans. And there is downside risk here, especially in these ad markets that it plays in. It's got a long and checkered history. It's been through all kinds of fits and starts and listings. Those who've been around the market quite a while like me will remember Blinks, 2004 to 2007, Rhythm One, Taptica. It's ended up renamed as Tremor and recently bought video ad platform Unruly from News Corp. All these buy and build acquisitions have turned it into an end-to-end video ad platform that's integrated from content production right through to distribution. This provides benefits for both publisher clients and advertising clients. And they also have a data platform to optimize the distribution of adverts. Andy Brough said, I think in a PI World video recently, in media and advertising, you need a platform. And they've got one now, and it's holding out possibility for rapid profit growth and revaluation. It pivoted from pure performance marketing into this more specialized branding videos in 2019. It's a much more profitable revenue mix, which kind of marked an inflection point in the group's evolution. So it's got about 95 of the top 100 brands using the platform. And as an example, it's got exclusive access to sell video adverts for about 50 News Corp titles. So this progression has continued right through COVID. Recent history, in March, late March, they had a trading statement with those wonderful words, significantly ahead of expectations for the full year ending December 2021. And FinCap have upgraded their forecast 5 times since September 2020. Last time around was about a 20%, 25% upgrade in EBITDA. So there's real earnings momentum here. And also they've announced they're doing a US listing expected in Q2 2021. It's filed with the SEC for an IPO, a dual list, and they're at a major discount to their US peer group, PubMatic, Magnite, Trade Desk, and it's growing substantially faster and more profitable than all three. FinCap recently said they don't expect that Tremor's current valuation will be sustainable due to market or external interest. Their target price is £12, that's 76% above the current slightly consolidating share price, and that's it. There are bear points. Advertising's prone to boom and bust, regulatory risk, and there has been some director selling, but generally this has got some good near-term catalysts and a lot of earnings momentum. That's really it for the 3 minutes.
Thanks, Ed. So how can the stock rank be so high when the return on capital employed and the operating margins are both negative?
Well, you have to ask the algorithm that, but it focuses a lot on gross profitability. It focuses a lot on a whole range of factors, including Piotrowski F score and other variables as well. So these sort of things come up quite a lot in multi-factor rankings, where you can actually have a kind of a lower sort of current profitability, but actually due to gross profitability and other factors, actually can come through quite high.
Thank you. And are you not worried about the threat of Google or YouTube changing the way it works? And with these publishers, a simple change there could have a catastrophic effect on their profitability?
Yes, of course. And there's been a lot in the press lately about, you know, Apple and others becoming a bit more kind of, you know, creating more restrictions on ads. I don't pretend to be an expert. And as I said, this has always been a volatile part of the market and a volatile marketplace. So, you know, but this has been a real buy and build situation. They've only recently been able to benefit from this complete end-to-end delivery that they have in terms of content production for brands and actually this whole supply side and demand side of their platform. So they're in a much better place than they ever were when they were back being Blinks or whatever. But I mean, you know, the ad market's here to stay. It's not going to disappear, but it will always suffer from certain big platform and regulatory, you know, interaction. And we'll see where it ends up.
Thank you. And what do you think is the right multiple for this type of business with respect to that? What do you think is fair value?
Well, it depends. If you list it in the US, then probably 90 times forecast, I think. I mean, if you put it in against its peer group on Stockopedia, and we've got a link in a recent blog that Jack kindly wrote up on the site, and there was a link to Magnite and PubMatic and various others. And I think the nearest valued company was 50% premium, and a couple of them were at 2, 3, maybe even 4 times the valuation. So look, you know, I'm born in Scotland. I'm actually a pretty tight investor. And this one is definitely above the valuation that I like buying my shares at. And very much this is for me a speculative position based on some of these factors described, and especially the kind of US listing, which of course may not go ahead. US market's correcting quite a bit recently. But I think, you know, that you get the, in this sort of sector, you get profits in real fits and starts at times, and you can get really outsized profits. And I think what you're seeing at the moment in this sector is a period like that, where you're getting a lot of extra cash flow, and there could be quite significant dividends and so forth to come.
And you're not bothered about director sales?
Well, there have been some director sales. I mean, you know, directors sell for a lot of reasons. And I think it's important to understand that open market director buys have a lot of alpha. Open market direct sales often have less so. An example would be Way Education, where all the directors sold, and they sold probably at half the price it ended up actually getting acquired at. So something like Tremor, I do see potentially a sort of bid target due to the valuation dispersion, valuation discount versus its peers. And, you know, the directors who sold, I've had a look at it. Some of them have sold, yes, potentially up to 10% of their stake. But remember, it has gone up 7 times. And if I was looking at my stake in that business and I was a holder, you know, last March, and you thought, well, if the market's crashed again, you know, I can understand why some people might want to sort of cash in some of that equity.
Tremendous, Ed. So let's see what the audience think. 35% buy, 24% sell, and the largest proportion will watch. Ed, thanks very much indeed. Back to you, Damien.
Cool. Thank you, Ed. Very good. I haven't seen many companies, as we said, with earnings rising over 12 times in the space of a year, and with the growth looking sustainable. And the share price is definitely playing catch up, because it's only quadrupled in the last 6 months. And I could almost be tempted if only the CEO and CFO weren't continually selling 6 and 7 figure volumes of shares. But hey, can't win them all, can you? So next up now, we have William Woodward, who's going to talk about Orchard Funding.
Hi, so Orchard Funding is a founder-led group that provides credit to businesses to allow them to spread the cost of their insurance premiums or professional services or other services over up to 12 months. So why was I attracted to this share? So I saw the value rank in the 90s, which I like. It was trading at a discount to its tangible book. And on a normalized basis, the PE ratio is between 6 and 7 on the average profit figure for the last 5 years. So aside from price, what I also like is the management have skin in the game. The founder owns over 50% of the business. And on top of that, he's been in this industry since 2002. In terms of barriers to entry, the main business, which is the insurance premium finance business, is extremely dominated by two very large players who have 91% market share, which makes it difficult for large entrants to come into this industry. But somebody like small like Orchard seems to have been able to survive. revenues are also sticky in insurance because people have to pay their insurance. It's not something you can get out of. In terms of growth, they've managed to successfully expand into adjacent markets, such as accountancy fee funding and more recently private school fee funding, all of which was going really well prior to COVID. So I think in the early part of the 2020 financial year, they were growing the lending book at 4%, and they'd added 30 schools to their school fee funding business. Then COVID hit. Another thing that I like is that their loans have a short tenor, so they're only 10-month loans. So if interest rates do rise, they're not overly exposed. In terms of the bear case, of course, the stock is small and illiquid with a market cap of 11 million. And there's quite a wide spread. I think it's 4 or 5 pence, which will put a lot of people off. CEO pay is also quite high at 250,000 for a business with an 11 million market cap. And that was not reduced during COVID. He kept it the same. But the business still made £1 million even through its most difficult year. One point I would like to draw everyone's attention to is that the firm was looking like it would have a banking license, which is why the shares used to trade at 100 pence. That hasn't worked out. There's been a change of chairmans. They've parked that to one side for now. But in my view, we need to value the business as if it won't have it. And it still looks cheap on that basis. There's some quality shareholders on the registers, including Harwood Capital and Lions Trust. And it's one of the few shares that's not priced for a return yet to 2019 levels. And I can't see why it won't get there. It'll earn 1.7 million profit and I hold.
William, thanks very much. Perfect timing. The chart looks awful. The share price has almost halved since 2015. What's going to change this?
Well, I think what will change it is that there will be a normalization of profits. So although they have traded profitably, they have dropped. And I think share prices follow earnings. So when there's some more news to shout about in terms of improved earnings, which we're expecting in the next 12 months, then I think the share price will follow suit. But I don't think this will be a multi-bagger. I think it might get back to 80 pence, which I would be happy with. But we have the inbuilt optionality that when the banking license is back on the agenda, then obviously there's a lot more potential upside. They also own a small stake in an open banking software business. I think the management are very cognizant of fintech. And so they are focusing their business on that. And they have a software solution called LendXP of their own for their clients. So there is some inbuilt things to be optimistic about. The share price will go up. Things only have to get less bad rather than really good.
And who are the two big competitors, and have those companies created a lot of value for shareholders historically?
So the two big competitors are Premium Credit, and the other one is Close Brothers, that I'm not overly familiar with, but I would say that in terms of Close Brothers, they're listed and they trade at 2x book compared to this at 0.7 of book. And this company lends 75% of its loans from finance it gets from Barclays, whereas the competitors don't put any of their own money into the loans. They need 95% of the finance, then lend it all on. So margins are strong in this smaller competitor because they've managed to build up their book over the last 5 years.
Thank you. And it looks like the CEO has 53% of the stock. Is that not unattractive?
Yes, and his wife owns some as well, so it's even more than that. But I think that founder-run businesses is something I really like. I like family-run businesses. I think you're either in the camp that likes that or they don't. And if you don't, then this isn't the share for you. But he's not someone who's being paid by a load of stock options. He's invested his life in building this business and gets his living from the dividends. So it could also be interesting for income investors because the yield is nearly 6%. And the 3p dividend just kept rolling in all through the worst of COVID as well. So there's that to keep you, if you want to be patient, then at least you've got the dividend while you wait.
Tremendous. Thank you very much indeed. So let's see what the audience say. 19% would buy, 37% would sell, and 45% would watch. Thank you very much indeed, William. And back to you, Damien.
Thank you, William. That's another company I've previously seen present at ShareSoc, and this time back in 2017. This is one of those cases where the CEO is stuck with his plan, which was quite sensible, and yet has been thwarted by external headwinds. Still, as people have pointed out, he hasn't sold a share since then, so he must remain optimistic this hard work is going to pay off in the end. So, yeah, wish him all the best. Next up, we have David O'Hara, who's going to talk about Celtic. And just to say, we've had some connection issues, but hopefully David will be here, even if he hasn't got a camera. Over to you, David.
Damien, hi. Celtic PLC is an AIM-quoted football club. The PLC owns 100% of the football club. It also owns the stadium and any of the requisite playing assets. Celtic is a storied football club. It has a global fan base. And unlike, say, people like love Apple because people buy an iPhone, commitment to a football club is actually generational. You inherit it and pass it on. That's how dedicated the fan base is of a football club. The market cap is £140 million. Watch out here, because there's quite a lot of convertible shares that you need to work into your calculation. So I make the market cap £140 million with an enterprise value of £125 million because Celtic PLC is a net cash business. The business model for the last 15 years or so has really been to identify young, promising players in European and foreign leagues, acquire them for Celtic PLC, put them in the shop window in international European club competition, and then sell them on. And so there's tremendous doing so, like Victor, Moussa Dembélé, and the most celebrated player they've done this with in recent years is Virgil van Dijk, regarded as probably the world's number one centre-half at the moment. So the company has a good track record of buying those players, selling them on, and it has earned revenues from ticket sales and also from player trading. The recent fury over the European Super League was driven by European clubs' desire, biggest clubs' desire for more income than the current Champions League settlement gave them. I think the demands of those big clubs will be hard to resist in the long term, as they are the big draw for television subscribers and for sponsors. Now, Tottenham shares are quoted on Asset Match, and their valuation puts the club in an enterprise value of around £1.3 billion. Liverpool FC recently turned down a £3 billion bid. The latest TV settlement in the English Premier League runs for 3 years and is on the same terms for the clubs. No growth. Most overseas deal for Premier League clubs came in at just 8% growth. Now, the European Super League failed because of a lack of support and authorisation from UEFA. That meant that players at European Super League clubs would have been ineligible for international competition, and therefore they weren't interested, as they wouldn't be able to play in the tournament, so it's just not viable for the clubs to employ them and wouldn't be able to do so. But a route does exist for English six clubs to substantially increase their revenues in the future, and that is via a British Premier League. Now, this has support from UEFA, because UEFA permits cross-border leagues. There are five Welsh teams playing in England, for example. And furthermore, there will be significant political support, I believe, from the government for a British Premier League, which would likely end up featuring Scottish giants Celtic and Rangers. So you'd then go from having a big six, who people subscribe to television, who pay for TV subscriptions to watch, to a big eight. That's 30% bigger. You'd have the 30% more blue ribbon clubs in the British Premier League than you do have in the English Premier League. So if you were to add 30% to Spurs enterprise value, you'd get £1 billion value for the club. But Celtic's enterprise value is just £125 million. And the status quo is likely to endure for the duration of the next TV deal. But I can see some new venture regarding a British Premier League emerging in the next 2 years from now. If Celtic's enterprise value were to rise to £2 billion, equal to what Tottenham Hotspur was speculated to be in the British Premier League, then that's a 15-bagger on Celtic's share price. Thank you. I hope I haven't raced through that too quickly.
David, thank you very much indeed. So first of all, we need to know, are you a Celtic football supporter?
No, I'm not. And I'm neither a shareholder in the club.
Thank you. Is Celtic's period of domination now over with Rangers back on top?
Yes, I believe it is, because the Celtic need to appoint a good football manager. The period of domination ended because they ceased to do so. I think the interesting thing is here is I think that was a failure of PLC board management, actually. But I think the right managerial appointment could see Celtic's domestic revenues increase and hopefully some European revenues in the Champions League as well. But really, this is a speculative investment based on the idea of the formation of the British Premier League with Celtic as part of it.
Thank you. And does the Scottish FA place a limit on dividends payable as the Football Association does?
I'm not aware of that. Their dividends being paid has never really happened at Celtic PLC, but there hasn't been any substantial equity issuance either. If you look on the Stockopedia page, I think that might be adjusted by the ordinary shares being a bit changed to convertible shares and backs them forward. But there's been no material dividend payouts, and there's been no material equity issuance either. It's currently a net cash business. Watch out for the net cash value, because obviously that fluctuates with player dealings, with transfer dealings.
Thank you. And does the spread concern you?
Yes, it does. And that's why this is an interesting thing, right? So we go to Leary List, not because no one is really participating at this price, okay? There's no fund manager participation because of the lack of liquidity. A lot of the shares are actually owned by fans who don't really participate in the stock market as we do, right? So that just leaves us, really. And there is some volume from day to day caused by fans selling or small shareholders selling, and that should allow people like us ourselves to get on board.
And what happens if Scotland votes for independence?
I don't think that would affect the football situation at all. But obviously, I think there will be some support for British government for a British Premier League. And I suppose it just have to get renamed, won't it?
And all clubs are looking for the best young talent, and the competition's really fierce. What makes Celtic better at doing this?
Well, you can't get someone from, well, you can, but you get someone from, I was going to say Timbuktu, to come and play for Celtic for a football club's youth side. Players do move internationally now, but at a later age, after which they've already shown lots of promise. So Celtic obviously simply got a catchment area like school has, whatever, and where it can bring in players. And it's proven that if a young player joins Celtic, they can go on to have a full career. I mean, Kieran Tierney established probably one of the Premier League best full English Premier League fullback players. He's a graduate of Celtic. It's that shop window that Celtic can provide.
Thank you, David. And that's the end of questions. So the audience say buy 4%, sell 72%, and watch 24%. David, thanks very much indeed. And back to you, Damien.
Cool. Thank you, David. This is one of those times where I have nothing to add, as I know nothing about football and how these clubs work in the public markets. However, I know a lot more about it now after your presentation, so thank you. And finally, for the last presentation already, we have Rob Mahan coming up, and he's going to talk about, if I can say this correctly, Sørgatnæft Gas. So take it away, Rob.
Cheers, Damien. So Sørgatnæft Gas is a huge Russian oil and gas company. So it's an unpopular share in an unpopular sector in an unpopular country, but it's got a great valuation. And I think a few catalysts. So in a few years, you can get a decent return. And if you hold it a certain way, you can get a decent yield while you wait. So it's listed as a GDR in London and an ADR. And as in Moscow, there's ordinary shares and preference shares. I own the preference shares. Stockopedia shows the ordinary shares, but it gives you an idea of the business. And there's arguments for and against each of them. The cash and cash equivalents of Serga are 52 billion, which is double the market cap and almost as much as the Russian sovereign wealth fund. And it's also got an oil company that's effectively free. And it's not a small oil company. It's got 112,000 people working for it, producing 1.2 million barrels of oil a day, 20 or 30 years of reserves. If you look back at the chart, if you just go back to, I don't know, 3 years, say. There we go. You can see a bit of a spike back in early 2020. That was rumors that it might take over Lukoil or another big oil company and actually do something with the cash. So it proves the cash is real. It gives you sort of earnings on the cash. That didn't come to anything. Obviously, COVID happened. There's obviously moves in the oil price that do affect it, even though it is mostly a kind of a cash shell with a free oil company. The man in charge is Vladimir Bogdanov, who took control in 1984. He's now 70 years old. He might move on shortly, or new management, new blood might want to do something with the cash. It's often been talked about. It doesn't make a lot of sense. There are some big reputable shareholders, the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund, but one of the big reasons this is so cheap is that they don't have any kind of shareholder list. No one knows who owns it. There's some good evidence it might just be management amongst themselves. Some rumors say Putin owns the whole thing. No one really knows. And that is a good bit of why it's so cheap. It's held by a series of companies that are sort of under a 5% disclosure limit. So the bulk of the shares, no one knows. The ordinary shares, if you get in now, you're getting in a reasonable price. If you go out further, you can see these shares haven't traded much above, say, $4 a share. And you're getting, say, a 1.5% yield. But if you want a yield with less upside, there are preference shares, which have just announced about a 15% yield, which is what I own. This is determined by a formula. So it's 10% of the Russian accounting profit divided by 15% of the share count. And they kind of have to pay that out. Okay. So that's it.
Rob, thanks very much indeed. Why has the share price been so lackluster when oil and gas prices have risen so much in the last 9 months?
The ordinary share price has been lackluster because it's pretty much a cash shell with an oil company attached. So it's much more, it doesn't move a lot with oil and gas. That's not what moves it. People want to see a return that it's not going to be sort of stolen from or just disappear. They want to make sure that it's on the level.
And if we don't know who owns the company, what's going to drive the share price?
Well, we've got suspicions it's management, and whoever owns it still has an economic incentive to turn that $20 billion into the $50 billion or more by doing something with the assets. Even the Russian state has an incentive to kind of use that cash to do something. It's too much cash. Apparently, if they pull the cash out, it undermines the Russian banking system. It's a ridiculous amount of cash.
Thank you. And how do you buy the preference shares? What's the ticker?
The preference shares, I can't remember the ticker off the top of my head, but you can buy it via Interactive Brokers in Moscow. I think there's an American ADR. I don't believe it's ISAable. So you're going to have to pay tax on the any gains and the dividend.
Don't you feel it's rather risky? What's your investing strategy, asked someone?
I don't believe it's rather risky because it's been in existence for years. It's been paying out a 15% dividend on the pref for years. I hold this 5-10 years. It more than pays for itself. And I've got the optionality of when they do something with the cash. I don't think there's a huge amount of risk that this thing will disappear. It's too big. Some of the scandals around Browder were when they stole some money out of this. They're probably not going to do it again. And I think I'm well compensated for the risk by the return, although I've got to be very patient, perhaps.
And after Wirecard, how do we know the cash is real?
How do you know the cash is real? That's a good one. I mean, they do have an auditor, but that's not worth much. Everyone in Russia believes it's real. They believe it might be stolen, but the cash is believed to be real. I don't know how you know it. Sorry, don't know. You just have to believe, like everything else.
And can you just explain before we finish how to buy the preference shares again? Someone missed it and there's been lots of questions on it.
You buy the preference shares via Interactive Brokers. You can buy them with other stockbrokers are available or a local Russian broker, but I would go with Interactive Brokers in the first instance. There's a bit of risk, I'll warn you, of like sanctions and various political things that could, say, make Interactive Brokers drop Russian shares or things like that. I think the risk of that's pretty minimal. It's not happened before, but you never know.
Certainly not one for widows and orphans. So what do our audience think? 17% think buy, 48% think sell, and 35% think watch. So, Rob, thank you very much indeed. And Damien, back to you.
Well, thank you, Rob. That is a very interesting company to end the stock slam with, and clearly deep value. I don't know if I've personally got the guts to put in my SIP, since it can't go to nicer, but I can see the opportunity, and I do quite like the fact that no one knows who owns the company. That's really quite remarkable. And anyway, that, as I said, is the end of the Stock Slam. It really passed quickly. We hit 1,000 attendees, which is really great, given how hard it was to find less than 100 people in real life. I hope you all enjoyed the presentations this evening. I've learned a great deal personally about some new companies, and I hope you have too. So please join me in thanking all the presenters for giving up their time to entertain and inform. And remember, if you want to go back over any of the pitches, there's going to be a video recording available by the weekend, which is always worth a watch because it's very easy to miss something. I would definitely like to thank Tamsin and Tim from PI World for hosting the event, and Sam from Stockopedia for helping organise things. It's not a one-man business, I can tell you. Still, I'm certain that we can get even better than this, and we would be grateful if you can give us some feedback on tonight's event. This will help us next time, and I'm pleased to say we've already chosen a date for the next event. It's going to be on Wednesday, June the 23rd at the same time, and this will probably be our last event before the summer break. So put that in your diary and, well, even think about pitching. That would be great. I mean, many of the people tonight were pitching for the very first time, and I thought they did an excellent job. Really great. Everyone's had to start somewhere. And finally, I'd like to thank all of you in the audience for logging on this evening and joining in the conversation on Discord. We wouldn't have an event if you didn't come. And if you want to continue this conversation on Discord or Twitter, that'd be fantastic. Have a great evening.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.